Well, over the weekend, there was a bit of an election result that came through. One of the interesting things, though, in the whole US election, and I guess you probably would say over the last few years also, has been the sorts of comments that have come with the presidential seal. And I guess in other aspects from other people, maybe an alternate reality or an alternate history in many people's views. In fact, you might have been aware that when the President Donald Trump was making a statement on Friday, many of the major TV networks, MSNBC, NBC News, CNBC, CBS News and ABC News, as well as National Public Radio, all decided to cut away from a Donald Trump press conference because of misleading statements he was making live across the air. Have a listen to how things played out on NBC News with anchor Lester Holt.
We're watching President Trump speaking live from the White House, and we have to interrupt here because the president has made a number of false statements, including the notion that there has been fraudulent voting. There has been no evidence of that, allegations by his campaign, but his campaign spokespeople unable to provide any evidence. He also has suggested that the polls, and many of which were incorrect, were somehow the product of election interference. Chuck Todd, Andrew Mitchell with me here. Hate to cut away from the president, but...
Look, he's trying to set a narrative.
Look, that was just one of the examples of that. But I guess it's an example of, you know, many alternate realities that have tried to be created. So how do we look at this world of post-truth? Dr. Ben Jones has been looking at it very carefully. Ben is an historian at CQ University and the author of History in a Post-Truth World, Theory and Praxis. Dr. Jones, good afternoon. Welcome.
Afternoon, Sonia. Pleasure to talk with you.
Was that shocking to you on Friday? I mean, I know we've seen this quite a lot of times, but it's one of the first times I've seen news organisations pull away from a presidential conference for that reason.
Well, yes, it wasn't shocking to me that Trump said those things and set out a narrative with no evidence to support it. But it was a shock to me that the journalist took the principled stand, in my opinion, of cutting away and correcting the narrative, or at least establishing that whether you believe it or not, there's no evidence has been provided. And frankly, I wonder if Australian journalists would have acted the same. I don't think an Australian Prime Minister has ever given a live talk with so many blatantly untrue things. But I think it would be an interesting test of the veracity of our own journalism to see if they argue that, well, it's an important person giving a speech and people have the right to hear it, or if they feel that as journalists they have an obligation to correct some of those falsehoods.
Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Whenever Donald Trump's name is brought into the fore or the discussion, you have people who think you're either for or against, whether you support him or not, as though it's a personal attack against him. You're talking about the things he said there, and already one of the first texts I have is, you think the whole of Australia hated Trump? Think again, media. Over 70 million voted for him, and way more in Australia approve of him also than you think. But typical, you just rave on with your own hateful agenda. We're not talking about support here. We're talking about the things that are said and whether there is evidence for them. So how do reactions like that play into the sorts of, you know, sorts of arguments you're giving on this one, Ben?
Well, yeah, absolutely right that a response like that and a framing like that is a feature of the post-truth, where it's not actually whether the things being said are correct or not or can be backed up with evidence, but it's whether you're perceived to be attacking or defending whoever it is. It might be useful, though, just to outline the definitions. So post-truth was the 2016 Oxford Dictionary word of the year because it spiked astronomically in usage after Donald Trump's election and in 2016 and also Brexit. And it means when emotions and personal feelings matter more than facts and evidence in shaping someone's opinion. And that's been used a lot in politics. And what my book is about is applying this specifically to the discipline of history. And there are all different types of historical falsehoods that have always been around. People have always told lies. People have always shared and spread propaganda. There's always been pseudo-history. But the thing about all those types of mistruth is when someone is actually trying to trick you, the purveyor of the information is trying to trick the receiver, whereas post-truth history is when there's actually an unspoken pact between the purveyor and the recipient of the false information where they're indifferent to truth. So it's not that they're against truth. If they can find some truth that helps their narrative, they'll take that. But overall, the facts of the matter aren't as consequential as the narrative and the ideology they want. And I think that texter you mentioned is sort of an example of that, where, you know, they hadn't even listened to what facts or evidence we might be discussing. It was just an instinctive response to what's perceived as an attack.
Yeah, so let's talk about that then. I mean, why can't we just call post-truth lies? Is it more nuanced than that?
Yeah, well, I think that is the key difference, though, because if you think of it as lying, then you think, well, the solution is just to present the truth. So if someone believes, and it doesn't have to be Trump, it can be anything. If someone believes something that you're aware is wrong, and you say, well, if I just get the book and show them the evidence, or if I just pull up the statistics to show that's wrong. So, you know, on climate change, for instance, someone who's saying that the Earth isn't getting hotter, some people think, well, I just need to go and get the statistics from NASA or from the CSIRO, and that'll set them straight. And then there's this frustration of saying, well, we've provided you with the correct evidence. How have I not convinced them? And often we've pushed them even further into their silo. And so and part of the reason for that is it's not about lying. It's about the person receiving the information already deciding what they want to believe and what ideology they agree with. And then it's this process of filtering information, whatever stacks up with their pre-existing biases, they'll say that's right. And evidence to the contrary can be, with a scary easiness, can be dismissed.
And so opinion, I think most of us seem to realise, is being pushed up there as equal to truth. And in some case, trumping truth, yeah?
Absolutely. And so another key element in the post-truth world is that expert knowledge is undermined. And so it's this attitude that it's elitist to say, well, that's the, you know, the leading doctor or in a certain field says this. And someone says, well, you know, I Googled on, you know, I Googled for a few hours and why isn't my opinion equal? Isn't it anti-democratic? We usually like the word democratic. It usually is a good thing, and it is in terms of political organisation. But if you have a democratisation of knowledge, I think that's an incredibly dangerous and harmful situation, because all knowledge isn't equal. There is a hierarchy.
But as you said, this has been going on throughout history. Not only has there been propaganda in certain countries, we've mm-hmm. also, and perhaps all countries in different measures, but we've seen the rewriting of history through omission and through even perhaps more deliberate means. So why is this a different era?
If it is, and people certainly can debate if post-truth history is anything new, it's to do with the fact that we get so much of our information from social media, and the way that we interact with each other, it is so much easier to silo yourself off into a little world. You block the people who say things that challenge your beliefs. You add the people who reinforce it. And it becomes a lot easier to almost delude yourself that to whatever reality suits you. If I could just quote Steve Tesich for a second here, because he speaks to this, and he's commonly called the guy who coined the term. He's talking back in 1992 in the United States. He says, we're rapidly becoming prototypes of a people that totalitarian monsters could only drool about in their dreams. All the dictators till now had to work hard at suppressing the truth, but we by our actions say that's no longer necessary. And what he's saying is that if you go further back in history, especially dictators, they had to work very hard at trying to make their propaganda look convincing. Whereas in the social media age, you can put together a quick meme in a matter of minutes, which can have wildly incorrect information. In fact, we've got an example in the book where virtually every single thing in the meme is incorrect. But if it hits the right emotional note with people, it gets shared as if it is the truth.
And so while there are those who would think we're talking about this simply in relation to Donald Trump, I mean, this is something that exists, has existed well before and separately to him. What has Donald Trump added to this then? Has he exploited it? Has he harnessed it? What has he done?
Well, I think he's the prime exemplar of just how far into a post-truth world we have gone. So it would have been conventional wisdom before that politicians have always put their spin on things to make them look good. That's a very stock standard thing. But to simply deny facts, to simply deny figures coming in from accepted sources, to simply say there was voter fraud and not feel any obligation to provide evidence, you could call it a new audacity in the post-truth that he seems to have tapped into. He seems to be very aware that he has a follower base who will believe whatever he says. And so it's no longer necessary to go to all this effort of trying to create convincing propaganda to trick people, when instead you can cultivate, in his case, a kind of hero worship that has taken place.
I'm talking with Dr. Benjamin Jones. He's an historian at CQ University and author of History in a Post-Truth World, Theory and Praxis. Benjamin, when it comes to indifference, you said at the beginning that there is an indifference. Can you explain how that plays out and what this deal is between the giver of lies and the receiver of lies or myths or whatever we're talking about in relation to this?
Yeah, well, one example we use in the book is this internet meme that has just been spread thousands and thousands of times. It's a racist meme from the United States. And just to describe it, it has a black and white photo of some very poor looking children, sort of turn of the century. And I'll edit out the swear words, but it says, "White Irish slaves were treated far worse than any other race in the US. When was the last time you heard an Irishman complaining about the world owing them a living? You won't, because they're not whingers looking for free stuff." So it's directed straight to an audience who believe that African Americans are whingers and are just complaining and want free stuff. Now, every single thing in that meme is historically incorrect. The photo isn't of Irish slaves. It's sort of turn of the century breaker boys, they were called, who worked in coal mines. There was no such thing as Irish slaves as well. There were Irish indentured servants who were often treated terribly, but their legal status was, was certainly different to slavery, which was for life. And, I could go on with it. There is just so many things incorrect with that, not least that Irish indentured servants often voluntarily went into that situation. They exchanged 5 to 7 years of labour for their passage to the United States. So, but the thing is, if you've got someone who agrees already with this sort of racist idea that African Americans are just whinging and want free stuff, you can tell them that photo isn't of Irish slaves. You can tell them why it's different, why it's incorrect. But if they've already decided for ideological reasons that's what they want to believe, then it has this sort of terrifying ability to go viral. And particularly with social media, it can get shared directly to groups who they know want that kind of material and are going to like that kind of material and aren't going to question its historicity.
So there is a deal that the receiver of this information makes in saying, I will only believe what backs up my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes it so much easier for the people who want to spread post-truth information. They don't need to. So if you take the example of Holocaust denial, this has gone on ever since the Holocaust. And during the Holocaust, it was denied then. It's been denied ever since. But to try and make some leeway, because you know, there was more credence put on the opinion of historians and academics, Holocaust deniers went to all this effort of creating these journals that sort of had the same look as academic journals, and they would try and find footnotes, and they'd present things in a, you know, they'd go to enormous amount of effort to try and present Holocaust denial as a legitimate exercise in historical revisionism. And while that still happens to an extent, it is far easier. And as a result, we've seen a huge rise in Holocaust denial. And one of the chapters is about that, and anti-Semitism more generally. But they don't need to spend hours and hours creating these academic looking books to spread propaganda anymore. It can be as simple as just, well, someone like Alex Jones just ranting on InfoWars, because people who already agree with it aren't going to demand to see your footnotes and demand to see the evidence.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Dr. Ben Jones, Deb on our text line has said, by the news presenter not letting the viewers hear what Trump was saying, whether truth or not, or just plain rubbish, surely that's a form of censorship. Is it censorship to stop misinformation?
Well, I don't think that's what, you know, really happened. Trump did get to say a lot, and you can get the full transcript just of him if you want. So in that case, I certainly don't think it's censorship in any way, shape or form. After he'd got to sort of his fourth or fifth false claim is when they cut away. So I think you hardly can call it censorship if they're just making it you know, slightly more difficult to get Trump's statement. You'd just have to go back to the White House to get a transcript of everything he said. And there probably is a larger obligation on the part of the media to cut away for, you know, a second, just to point out that these are unverified claims he's making.
Dr. Benjamin Jones, there's so much more to say, but interesting talking with you about that deal between the giver of the information and the receiver of the information, and opinion being up there with fact. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Sonia.
Dr. Ben Jones, a historian at CQ University and author of History in a Post-Truth World, Theory and Praxis.